Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 100, I chat with Alan Parsons about his incredible career as a producer, composer, engineer, and performing musician. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded February 27th, 2012. Episode 100, Alan Parsons Live. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, hassle, and money. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. This episode marks a very special moment in Home Theater Geeks. It's my 100th episode. And here to help me celebrate is a very special guest. I'm honored and privileged to welcome Alan Parsons to the show, legendary producer, composer, engineer, and performing musician. Hey, Alan, thanks so much for being here.
It's a great pleasure. Nice to be with you. And congratulations on surviving 100 shows. That's great.
Thank you. Well, with all the support I get from the TWiT network, it's really not too bad of a survival. It's more than survival. It's thriving. And I thank them all very much for that. Those who are tuned into the live stream at live.twit.tv or the tuned into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Alan as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Alan, you've had quite the career, some 40 years or so, starting back at Abbey Road Studios. And
basically started. I mean, I did actually have a brief period with the company that owned Abbey Road Studios, EMI Records at the time. I got to grips with quite a lot of things to do with audio at that time. It was an experience that was actually very useful because it meant that I started at Abbey Road with some audio experience. And
you didn't start there totally green, in other words.
That's right, yeah. It was actually a department that was making reel-to-reel tapes for commercial release.
Wow, they actually sold reel-to-reel tapes commercially?
They did. you've just reminded me how long I've been in this business now. But, cassettes were just around the corner. Cassettes were probably first started appearing round about, I think, probably 67, 68. That was about the time that I was getting the transfer to Abbey Road. So I never saw cassettes being made by EMI at that time. But like I said, it taught me about tape machines. I got to hear the Beatles, Pepper album, one of the first people to hear it. So that was great.
You bet. Not only that, you were there. You were helping engineer, I think, the last two Beatles albums, Abbey Road and Let It Be. Tell us a couple of stories from that? Here you are, by the way, at Abbey Road. Here's a picture for those of you watching the video. This is a little bit later than when the Beatles were there. But still, it gives you a sense of what the studio looked like.
The Eye in the Sky period is when that picture is from. Mm-hmm. But yes, I did. I was in the fortunate position of being an assistant engineer on the last two Beatles albums. The first one was Let It Be, released in reverse order, as most people know. Yes. That was down at their own studios, Apple, in Savile Row, London. And Abbey Road, of course, was done at Abbey Road. So,
mm-hmm.
Yes, I was there. Helping, making tea, fetching and carrying. no creative contribution that I'm particularly proud of, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, well, okay. Well, at least you were making tea. At that time, the Beatles were as I understand it, there was a little bit of tension in the group, at least maybe at the very last there. Did you see any of that? Or?
Well, what was interesting, particularly by the time Abbey Road came along, I mean, you could see from the photos that the well-publicized photos that Let It Be, that the faces were pretty long. Abbey Road, interestingly, was largely the work of individual Beatles. They didn't do a lot of stuff together. And George would come in and do, you know, work on something, and Here Comes the Sun. Mm-hmm. And Paul would come in and work on Oh Darling, and you know, the medley, his contributions to the side two medley, and John again just appeared for his own things. And Ringo would appear at the beginning of every day and ask if he was needed. And generally the answer was, no, Ringo, you can take off. We don't need you today. but it was, like I said, it was just individual Beatles. So they obviously did the basic rhythm tracks together. But once we got into overdubs, it was really one Beatle at a time.
Yeah. Wow. Well, did you happen to be there when they did their final concert? Was it on the roof of Abbey Studios, Abbey Road?
That was actually the roof of the Apple Building.
The Apple Building.
Yeah.
Were you able to attend that?
I was there. Yeah. I mean, there's if you look very closely at a couple of the photographs there, I'm wearing a pinstriped jacket with an orange shirt and a black knitted tie. Very trendy for the time. And, yeah, I was there. I was perhaps rather sadly, I was most of the time behind a camera, whereas I should have been in front of a camera so that I might have been seen more. But
indeed. You know. Curtis B. in the chat room asks, did you take part in any of the unreleased gems, as he calls them, from the Beatles that haven't been that haven't made it to bootleg?
They exist. I mean, I've not heard them since the time, but, you know, there's a wealth of tapes and outtakes and just messing around, you know, because because the film was being made, the multitrack was running at all times. So it wasn't a case of, you know, starting the machine into record when told to do so. That, you know, every second was recorded. Mm-hmm. So, there's a wealth of stuff out there. I don't have access to it. So
Curtis B. also asks, were you interested in music as a child? Did you start? This always your passion?
Yeah, I was always intrigued by all things musical, all things technical, to be honest. And that was, it was a big part of my upbringing. But I mean, both my parents were musicians. Not professionally. Well, actually, my mother was kind of professional. She was an actress and a harpist. She played the classic, which is like a Scottish miniature harp. And
oh, yeah.
She sang traditional Scottish folk songs professionally.
Mm-hmm. So you did come by it honestly then.
Oh yeah, that was a strong influence from my parents, definitely.
And of course, another of your credits that is so incredible is that you worked on Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Now, were you the recording engineer, mixing engineer, both?
I recorded the whole thing, start to finish, and I was very adamant that I would do that. I mean, there were other projects going on at the same time, of course. And there was a temptation to take other work on, that would actually conflict with working with the Floyd. But no, I managed to do every session, which was great. So much more satisfying than tea making. So.
And how was it working with the members of Pink Floyd?
Well, they were all getting on famously then. There were band, you know, inter-band conflicts. They all seem very, very comfortable in each other's company, and it was a joy to work on. Frankly, it was, we all got on well together. We you know, established pretty early on in the making of the record that we made a good team. And, you know, the results speak for themselves. My goodness, you know.
Well, yeah, they do. 30-some years later. A reader, listener, and a viewer of the show that I do with Leo Laporte wrote in, actually, in that with a question. With making of Dark Side of the Moon, there are so many different sounds, and you were probably limited by 8-track recording. Beatles started with 4-track, but you were probably at 8-track by the time of Pink Floyd or more, weren't you?
We were at 16. 16
tracks. Okay. Yeah. Today, it's easy to add more sounds on another track. And it was clear that you guys were all experimenting with new sound ideas and so on. Would you have added more sounds yet again had you had more than 16 tracks?
it's an interesting question. I think we were not really felt, we didn't really feel that we were limited by the 16 tracks. In fact, the album got transferred from a first generation 16 track to a second generation 16 track. And at that time, you know, those first 16 tracks were probably bounced down to 5 or 6, and then that would leave another 10 tracks to overdub onto. But that was the standard way of doing things. If you ran out of tracks, you made a copy to a second generation tape and made made more tracks available by doing that.
Yeah, of course you lose some quality. In those days, it was all analog, of course, and every time you bounced, you know, you had to lose some quality. Plus, you lost the flexibility. You had to pre-mix essentially those 16 tracks down to 4 or 5 or whatever, and then you—that was it. You had that mix.
It was a sort of careful selection of tracks that you combined. I remember in certain cases we were forced, because of the number of tracks we needed, we were forced to actually mix bass and drums all together in a pair of tracks. Mm. So that meant no future remixes. But of course, given today's technology, I think when James Guthrie mixed it for Surround recently, that he had the available technology to sync up the first generation tape with the second generation tape, so that he was able to go back to the original drums and bass on everything.
Now that reminds me of another question I wanted to ask you. You originally mixed Dark Side in Quadraphonic 4.0, right?
That's right. 4.0. No center channel, no sub bass channel. Just the four corners. Yeah.
So what is the difference then between that mix and the newer 5.1 mix that came out on SACD? Did you do that one as well?
No, that was James Guthrie who effectively took over my job when it was established that that Floyd and I were not going to do another album together. Although we did start another album, which was known as the Household Objects album, but my production career had already started to take off, and I think the Alan Parsons Project was only just around the corner at the time that we might have been making another album together. Mm-hmm. So it was James Guthrie did the SACD version. I did the quad version, but interestingly, they've both now been made available in a Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon box set. So my original quad mix is there for the first time, officially released. It's been bootlegged for some years, but it's actually now out there and available. And there's a perhaps. More exciting is that there's another mix that I did in stereo, which is probably at least 2 months before we finished the record. So you hear a lot of missing stuff and a lot of stuff that got removed.
That's in the box set too?
That's in the box set too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were you happy with the 5.1 mix that he did, or did you feel that...
The biggest upset for me was not being asked to do it. There was no communication about it. So I found out, after the event that, that James was doing it. Every engineer has his style. Every engineer has his own ways of doing things. And I would have done it differently, perhaps closer to the quad version. I've had very 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 positive feedback on the quad mix. People love it. Yeah, they think it's a real revelation compared to the stereo mix.
You were certainly a pioneer in multi-channel mixing. You also did Tubular Bells, Mike Oldfield's classic in quad, right?
I did. Yes, that was fun to do. Mike never appeared. It was just his producers and these guys at the back of the picture there. The guy to my to the guy standing right behind me. He's his name is Michael Thorne. He was at the time the editor of a magazine called Studio Sound. And behind my left ear, that's the assistant engineer Patrick Stapley. And the other two guys, with the one leaning over the console there, and the guy in the background, the bearded guy in the background. I'm afraid I can't remember their names, but they were, I think, the original engineers of the album.
Mm. Well, it was certainly one of that, and Dark Side of the Moon were among my favorite albums of all time, both of them. So great work.
Well, why do you? We aimed to please at the time.
Indeed. This all leads to a big question in my mind, which is, why do you think Quadraphonic wasn't more successful in the marketplace? It came and went, and it wasn't until we had Dolby Digital and so on that we really had surround sound.
I think the reason it failed was largely because the technology to bring it to the consumer on vinyl just wasn't very good. I mean, the channel separation was very much compromised. There was no placement allowed in the center of the room or the center of the back of the room, because when you did that, the signal went completely out of phase on the vinyl cutting head, and it would lift off. The cutting head would lift off. I just think the consumer wasn't really ready for it. The consumer is much more ready for it for 5.1, because it's become the norm for home theaters to have surround systems.
But sadly, digital technology makes it a little easier, channel separation and so on.
Mm-hmm. I mean the quality is superb now, the surround sound quality, but you still have to persuade people to have a room with five speakers in it and a subwoofer over the previous two speakers. For some reason, music is having a hard time reaching the consumer in surround. I think people accept that movie soundtracks are in surround, but persuading people to sit in their home theater and listen to music is something we have yet to really achieve in a big way.
Mm-hmm. Someone who identifies himself as Fred Flintstone in the chat room asks, did your work on Dark Side of the Moon influence the Alan Parsons project greatly?
I don't deny that that any people I worked with, any experience from the past had an influence. I'm comfortable feeling that Pink Floyd were an influence. Yeah, I mean I would never try and argue against that.
Virgila asks, what was the inspiration for the song Eye in the Sky?
Well, the guy who wrote the bulk of the song, unfortunately, is no longer with us. His name is Eric Wolfson. He died a little over 2 years ago.
You and he were the genesis of the Alan Parsons Project, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And he was the principal songwriter. I was the producer and engineer. So that's mm-hmm. that's how that team worked. There's a picture of us both. That's an Abbey Road Studio 2 on the floor of Studio 2 with the famous famous out of tune piano, a piano that was intentionally tuned out of tune to sound honky tonk. And well, the Eye in the Sky, I think if Eric was around, he would probably say it's a kind of a Orwellian 1984 kind of notion that that we are never alone, we're always being watched, and the Eye in the Sky can be a hidden camera, it can be a camera surveying a shopping mall, or a camera in a casino, making sure people aren't cheating at card games and so on. So it's all just a kind of mishmash of those notions. And like I said, a kind of Orwellian, kind of 1984. That.
And when was it written?
Well, the record came out in 82, so we were probably recording it, I'm guessing, possibly both 80 and 81, probably mostly in 81.
And so, in fact, it was probably more prophetic even than Eric might have realized, given today, with cameras everywhere and... And yes. Internet service providers monitoring your every move, and Apple tracking your iPhone and all that stuff. I mean, some of that isn't cameras specifically, but it does sound depressingly familiar.
Yeah, and the other sort of good thing about Eye in the Sky was that the intro, which is called Sirius, became arguably the most popular piece of APP music out there, because somebody involved with the Chicago Bulls heard it and said, that's a great theme song for my basketball team to walk on to. And it's been used countless times for other sporting events ever since. So, that was a great feather in my cap for... people often don't realize that it was the intro to Iron Sky, and unless you know? That's the album, you probably wouldn't know that.
Who would have thunk it? Curtis B asks, Eric was one of the main vocalists too, wasn't he?
Yes, he sang Iron Sky. In fact, he didn't really start singing until the previous album, which was The Turn of a Friendly Card. He had a hit singing a song on that album called Time, and it was clear that he that his voice was a voice to be reckoned with, and that he had the potential to have hits with that voice. I'm well documented as having resisted his contribution as a singer. But the results speak for themselves. So, I was clearly wrong.
Ah, right. A couple people in the chat room are asking, what kind of studio monitors do you use? And that's a great entree into maybe taking a look around your studio where you're sitting right now.
I could take the laptop and move it around a bit. The ones that you can see in the background here, these are Event Opals that I use for near field. To the left of that one there, so it's difficult to do this. You can see just peeping out here is that's a B&W. So I'm going to point it to one of the other ones because it's easier to see.
Those are somewhat larger. I guess they're a little bit more in the far field.
Yeah, I'm going to show you the one at the back of the room. That's a BMW, B&W 802 that I've had for probably 15 years now.
So it's not the Diamond series.
No, it's not the latest generation. Some people argue that the older version sounds better than the newer one. But
BMW was certainly a major. Presence in British recording studios for many years,
and they still are. In fact, when the 800 series came out, there was a lot of interest in studios and professionals who had until that time not not really considered BMW as a serious studio speaker, but the mm-hmm. the classical engineers always favored them ever since I can remember. Mm-hmm. But it just really didn't reach pop circles until a little bit later. Continuing the tour here, there's my it's my Mac computer screen. There's a Yamaha O2R 96 there, which is actually the only console I have. I tend to do most of my mixing here in the box. Sometimes
in the computer, you mean?
I tend to mix inside the computer. Yeah.
Right. And so you don't really need a Neve or a high end mixer at this point.
Well, there's a you can apply the word need in any way you want. I prefer the experience of mixing on a full size console. Because it's you have a fader and a channel for every sound source, and I like that. I like having that. And if I had the money and the space here to put a full size console, I would do it. But for studios have become smaller in recent years, and But that isn't to say that I'm not going to work in a commercial studio ever again. I mean, I do enjoy that experience. And if I'm recording a full blown band, I will always go to a commercial studio. And if I have a budget that will allow me to mix in a commercial studio, I'll do that too.
Sure. Beatmaster asks, what kind of software do you use for surround mixes? And more generally, what recording software do you prefer?
I've not done any mixing and surround with Pro Tools so far. I've always been in Cubase, and most of the recording I've done in recent years has been on Cubase. A little bit of Logic thrown in there as well, but Pro Tools is there's an enormous pressure to use Pro Tools because everybody else does, I'm pretty comfortable with Cubase, but these days I prefer to work with an engineer, a computer operator, because I feel that my training was in mic placement, balance, just achieving good sound with good audio techniques, and I'm not really. To get really good and to work fast with hard disk recording, you've got to do it every day. And in my old age, I'm not in the studio every day. So I like to work with an operator, a computer engineer.
Sure. We've had a number of questions in the chat room asking, who do you like listening to today? And relatedly, who would you like to have in your studio? Who would you like to work with of today's artists? I know there are plenty of choices, but...
Yeah, there's a lot of choice out there, it has to be said that if I'm listening to the radio, I'm going to most likely listen to classic rock radio, because that's where I come from. That's really really what I hear. But there are a lot of evergreens out there that are still doing it, still making great records. I mean, Sting is one of them. Sheryl Crow is another. I was very keen on Coldplay and Radiohead's music. If the opportunity arose to work with either of those, I would love it. Mm-hmm. I've always been a big fan of The Who. So if Pete Townsend was to call me with a request to make an album with him, I would jump at the chance. But new music. There's one or two acts in the recent history of music that I've liked. I mean, I thought Maroon 5 were a great band. A few things out there, yeah. But
didn't I hear you say once that you thought Adele was doing a good job? Adele.
Adele. Oh, yes, absolutely. Sorry, I only heard Dell. I thought Dell.
Yes.
Adele had an amazing voice, yes, and clearly talented, and she did great Grammy business. I'm sure she's going to be around for a long time.
And she walked all
over. She walked all over Madonna and Lady Gaga, didn't she? I mean, clearly she's the current big name.
Yeah. Did you happen to watch the Oscars last night?
I didn't. We were just doing email last night.
Yeah, understood. The only reason I ask is at one point in the in memoriam section, where they sort of pay tribute to people who died this last year, Esperanza Spalding sang "What a Wonderful World," and I've always thought she was a wonderful singer, also, and a great bass player.
Indeed. So they played a performance of it, or what?
Yeah, they performed it live. Performed an arrangement of the tune "What a Wonderful World" that
Louis Armstrong.
Louis Armstrong. Yeah, it was escaping me. Yes, that Louis Armstrong made famous. And she did it with a large children's choir backing her up, and the orchestra in the pit. And just sounded great.
I watched a YouTube video of Josh Groban with a children's choir, which was magic.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a voice, that's for sure.
Yeah, he does. He does indeed. Well, the fact that they do it live at the Oscars and also at the Grammys, which is another reason I really like to watch that show, also brings up the next question that I really wanted to discuss with you, which is sort of the difference between live performance and recorded music. I know that you yourself have done a lot of live performing, and I wonder how you feel about those two different experiences, producing a record or recording a record and performing live on stage.
Well, as the boss of a band, as well as being the producer in a studio, the roles are actually quite similar. But the only difference really is that as a performer, you can't be in charge of the sound. Effectively, you've got to leave that to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy both experiences. It was actually only comparatively recently in my career that I started playing live. We didn't play live until about 1994.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Quite a while went by. I mean, I think Eric and I felt that the Alan Parsons Project was totally a studio-based act, and that with my role as producer, there was really nothing for me to do. I mean, it's just. I could have gone on and announced the songs, told a few jokes, warmed up the audience, whatever. But I dusted off my acoustic guitar and learned all the chords of all the tunes, and we did our first tour of Germany in I think it was 1994. And it was great. I mean, everybody enjoyed it, including the audience, thank God. And we've been playing live in various incarnations of the Alan Parsons Live Project ever since.
Mm-hmm. I've always found it, as a musician myself, I've always found it, the main difference between performing live and in a recording studio is the energy of a live performance and the energetic exchange with the audience in a live performance that simply isn't there in the recording studio, which makes it a very different experience for me as a performer. I wonder if you feel the same.
Yes. I mean, it's been said countless times, you when you're recording, you can just do it over and over again until it's right. Whereas on the live stage, you only get one chance. Yes. And I think it's that immediacy, just like a live podcast. It has an atmosphere that you don't get any other way, and the live stage is just a great experience, and anybody who tells you otherwise is lying to you, because just standing on a stage and making an audience happy is just a great feeling.
Yes, I agree with you entirely.
That much longer, or I'm getting too long in the tooth for it.
Yeah, I don't suppose you want to live on a tour bus anymore, huh?
No, we don't do any of that stuff. All our touring has been, for the most part, at least. I mean, occasionally we jump on a tour bus, but generally we fly to wherever we're going to. Mm-hmm. Been doing a lot of appearances in Central and South America lately, and the distances between countries down there are far apart enough to warrant flying rather than driving.
Understood. Well, listen, we got a lot more questions in the chat room, and I've got a few more myself. But before we get to them, I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Netflix. Of course, most of our viewers and listeners know about Netflix, which lets you stream thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to your PC or your TV using just about any device in your home now. I mean, you can do it from your computer. You can do it from most TVs these days, Blu-ray players, game consoles, your smartphone, tablet PCs. It's available from just about any device, and you can put it on that big screen TV or watch it on your tablet. You can even start on one device and finish on another if you want. It saves you time, money, and hassle by streaming instantly without waiting for anything. Talk about instant gratification. It's really quite amazing. I've used it quite a bit myself to check out shows that I wouldn't normally see or that aren't even available on disc or certainly not being broadcast. But this is TV shows and movies when you want them, where you want them, no hassle, no time delay, and very inexpensive. In fact, you can even try it for free for 30 days thanks to Netflix offering a 30-day free trial for TWIT listeners and viewers. Just go to netflix.com/TWIT. Sure to use that URL when you're signing up for your 30-day free trial. That's netflix.com/TWIT. And we thank Netflix for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the TWIT network. So, Alan, a lot of people in the chat room.
On the subject of Netflix, real quick. I just signed up for an account with them. And they've got a really good selection of British programs, which makes me happy.
Excellent. There you go. That's wonderful. And but, in fact, I've been watching a lot of BBC TV lately myself.
Unfortunately, my internet connection is not through cable. It comes through a microwave link, which places a lot of demands on the available technology to do that. And I can only get a sort of medium quality picture, but you can choose that.
Right. Well, the good thing about it is that they can downshift it or upshift it depending on what your capabilities are.
Right.
Well, this brings up the whole question of the new distribution paradigm of music. You know, when you were growing up in the business, it was all reel-to-reel tapes, as you said at first, and then cassettes, and then finally CDs, physical media of various types. And now, of course, we have iTunes and online downloads and streaming and so on. What's your feeling about that big change, that big paradigm shift?
I suppose you could say it's virtual media rather than physical media.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's there's no stopping it now. I mean, I read in a national newspaper that most of the labels are saying they will discontinue CDs in the not too distant future. The only gripe I have in the download, the download world or the 21st century way of listening to music, is the quality is not there yet. MP3 is very convenient and very fast to download and stuff, but it's definitely not for audiophiles. And there must in order for me to stay interested in audio on download formats is to get that quality up. And thankfully, there are a few sites now which are we're addressing this issue and making higher quality downloads of WAV files as opposed to MP3 files available, mm-hmm. which is good news. But you have to be patient. You have to wait a little longer for it to download.
talk about instant gratification or lack thereof. So you're basically saying that the sound quality of MP3 just doesn't cut it for you.
I think it's great for for iPods and iPads on but if you're seriously listening at home, I think the better quality files are worth having.
Mm-hmm. One of the members of the chat room, I'm looking for the question now, and I can't find who wrote it, but there was a question I remember, which leads me into one area I wanted to talk to you about, which is how does someone get started in becoming a music engineer? And I know that you've done, you've released some programs to address that very issue.
The product you're referring to is called the Art and Science of Sound Recording. It's a three DVD series, which is devoted to everything you ever wanted to know about the recording studio and the art of recording. To get into the industry these days, particularly in the dwindling opportunities that exist for jobs in real commercial studios, there's need for education, and there are a large number of schools devoted to the art and science of recording. And I got together with an old friend called Julian Colbeck, who actually made a series of his own some 15 years ago. We decided it was time to update it and bring it into this century and do a new version. And it was much more adventurous, of course. I mean, this series is 9 hours of stuff. I mean, it's a lot of stuff to wade through. But sure. I'm glad we did it, and we're doing really well with it. You can order it at the website that's at the bottom of the screen right now. Great. Either one, actually, you can order it.
I looked at that the other night and saw that you can actually click on any of those links on the left-hand or right-hand side of the screen and actually view the video about microphones or EQ or monitoring and so on.
There's a little teaser 1 minute clip that you can see from each section if you choose to do so, just like on iTunes,
And exactly.
You can also you can choose to download the entire series as well if you want to. Mm-hmm. So it's totally downloadable as well as available on DVDs.
Other than going through that set of DVDs, which actually looks very good, as you said, there are places where you can go to get an education. Here in LA, for example, Musicians Institute is one place I know that offers a full range of courses on engineering. I think Full Sail Recording are they in Florida?
Yes.
Is another place that offers that. So there are schools where you can go and get full training. But as you say, and I think it's a very important point, the number of jobs available in commercial studios, such as you had when you were coming up in the business, are dwindling because the quality of what you can do in your own home now is starting to rival that of those big studios, except perhaps for the space to fit a whole orchestra in there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, we've reached the stage where anybody with a computer and GarageBand or a similar program can can record. All you need is a decent mic, and you're off, you know. And it means, I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. You can say that there's an awful lot of music out of there, a lot of which is going to be complete rubbish. But it's giving talented people the opportunity to express themselves, and I think that's great news. I'm hoping my wife will answer that phone. I'm sorry.
Okay, I hope it's not a call for a big gig or something. I wouldn't want you to miss that. let's see here.
Yeah, I mean, I think education is the key now. You've got to you've got to have some kind of guidance to get through the mire of technology that exists. And
right.
You know, we've attempted in the DVD series to bring that to the masses.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, almost anybody can record, but to do it well still requires training, experience, and just doing it over and over again and always improving and learning from your mistakes and from those who have gone before you, such as yourself. But I think it is possible to become a good engineer still these days. And if that's your passion, I say go for it.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that separates our programs from some of them, I mean, there are countless educational DVDs out there by well-known, you know, other well-known engineers and producers. But what I think separates us from theirs is that we include interviews with artists, producers, engineers, and so on, and get their take on something. So it's not always me saying this is how you do something. You get anecdotal stuff from a good range of famous artists, producers, and engineers.
Mm-hmm. Luis in the chat room asks, "What do you think about this new Mastered for iTunes initiative? Do you think that's going to improve the quality of sound, of the recorded sound of downloaded material?"
Mastered for iTunes, is that a service that somebody's offering?
To tell you the truth, I don't actually know myself. Perhaps Luis will tell me here. He wanted me to pass that along anyway.
I'm guessing it's just a sales pitch. It probably doesn't mean a whole lot other than. They listened to it, you know. They tried to get the MP3 sounding as good as they could.
Mm-hmm. Somebody else in the chat room back away asked whether you think higher end, higher bit rates like AAC help matters any, or what about, for example, FLAC, which is a lossless compression? That should really be the way to go, it would seem to me. If you want the highest quality,
Of course. I mean, lossless formats or high bit rate formats are definitely the way to go. And there's no real excuse to go forward with increasing internet speeds, increasing hard drive sizes on computers, and you know, all the technology always getting bigger and bigger, and the and the size of the units getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah, indeed.
But I think the way forward is to not fuss about the speed, because the speed will come. You know, we'll be able to, you know, download, you know, gigs of stuff in seconds one day.
I mean, yeah, we really indeed. Luis did send me the link to the article on ArsTechnica.com about Mastered for iTunes. Apparently, there's a section on the iTunes store that offers even a set of recommendations for engineers to follow when preparing master files for submission to the iTunes store. So, you know, maybe that will help somewhat. But I have to agree with you myself that really the ideal is, if you want the best quality sound, you're going to want uncompressed or losslessly compressed audio, even at higher bit rates than CD standard of 44.1 kilohertz, 16 bits. $24.96 and so on to really get that high quality experience. Which brings up the other question that I wanted to ask you. You and I talked at CES about this, and I just wanted to make sure we mentioned it here as well. You were at CES with DTS to basically promote the importance of quality in the audio experience. And that's really kind of what we're talking about here.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, DTS have for some years been at the forefront of that quest to try and, you know, get people listening to surround music for one thing. But, you know, their raison d'etre is totally about getting high quality audio into smaller spaces, and you know their surround format takes up no more space than a standard CD. In fact, it's essentially you know their surround releases have been on a form of CD which. You know, can be played on any CD player with a digital output, and then you just need a decoder to turn it into surround, and it's great. And then they're working on all kinds of codecs for even larger numbers of channels. I recently did a mix with them for 11.1 channels, and that's something that we demonstrated at the CES show as well.
Right,
and I'm not sure if that. Really, really seriously going to catch on. I mean, imagine the husband coming home to tell the wife, oh, we're going to have 11 speakers in this room, my dear. You know? And imagine the reaction. Yeah,
I've wondered about that. I've wondered about that as well. Jim Four in the chat room is asking, what do you consider your biggest hit and your favorite arrangement of the tunes you've done?
I missed the first part of the question. The biggest
What do you consider to be your biggest hit?
Oh, biggest hit! I think "Eye in the Sky," certainly chart-wise, made the biggest impression. Which is very very curious because I've never been allowed to forget that I didn't actually like the song very much when we first started, I was ready to drop it, ready to say no, let's move on to something else. But of course I changed my mind. It's great now. But we were a lot of trouble finding the right feel for it and trying to, you know. And I mean, I wish I had access to, or had a time machine and we could go back and just see what kind of changes we went through in the early versions of that song. But suddenly we found it with that sort of chuggy jig 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 feel that it has. So I'm very proud of that. I'm often asked which is my favorite of the albums. And I always give the same answer, and that's the first album, which was called Tales of Mystery and Imagination, and was based on Edgar Allan Poe's stories and poems.
Mm-hmm. A couple of people in the chat room have asked about that and asked whether or not you were a fan of Edgar Allan Poe, which I sort of assume you must be.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would have been pretty silly making an album based on his work without being a fan. Yes, that would have been crazy. No, we're a big fan. But I'm interestingly not much of a reader. I don't read much now except on holiday. But at school, I did a bit of reading when I was in school, and Poe was right in there. Loved him.
Yeah,
loved him.
Sure. Our engineer John says he really likes "I Wouldn't Want to Be Like You" and "I Robot."
That was another album that I'm very proud of. It was the second album. It was the first album we did with Clive Davis at the newly formed Arista label back in 77, I think. Mm-hmm. And "I Wouldn't Want to Be Like You." I think one of the shots I sent you has the singer of "I Wouldn't Want to Be Like You" in the foreground.
I think it's one of the live shots, John, if you want to pull that up.
The black and white. No, it was one of the black and white shots from Abbey Road. That's that. Yeah, there he is. That's Lenny on the left side. Mm-hmm. who sang Wouldn't Want to Be Like You. He also sang Games People Play, which is another of our biggest hits on the Turn of a Friendly Card album. Mm-hmm. And another interesting piece of trivia, that's a Fairlight that you can see in the foreground of the picture.
Oh, wow.
The Fairlight CMI.
Yeah, and then, I remember that.
To the right of the picture, that's a Linn drum, LM1 drum machine, one of the first available drum machines. So this was all very, very high-tech back in 1981.
Oh, man. I actually worked for Fairlight for a little while. I wrote some of their documentation and produced a newsletter for them, sort of at the end of their reign as a computer music system. Way too expensive.
they've come back with an instrument now, a hard drive instead of floppy, those big floppy disks.
Yeah, yeah.
I think once again it's out of most people's reach, price-wise.
Yeah. Yeah. Hermes in the chat room asks, "You've probably heard of the supposed correlation between Dark Side of the Moon and The Wizard of Oz. Is there any truth to that?"
No, it was Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It wasn't. It wasn't.
So no correlation. The Floyd wasn't watching Wizard of Oz and going, "Oh, let's put this together.
Anybody who seriously thinks there is a correlation has much too much time on their hands.
That's funny. Let's see. Diego Kidd asks a very technical question. How are you managing your data backup?
I've got an Apple Mac, I think it's called, it's a big white box. I can't remember the name of it, but it backs up every day, mm-hmm. all of my computers. And I'm pretty fanatic about always backing up projects to a different drive. And I think probably in the near future, I'm going to get some sort of cloud account going because I'm actually beginning to run out of space for all the drives that I've got lying around. And it's very important, especially, I mean, God forbid that if ever there was a fire here or at anybody's place where music is stored, you've got to take the view that is a possibility, and you've got to not mm-hmm. only back up, but back up at another in another location, another place.
Right,
and that's where the comes in. I think the cloud technology is fantastic for that.
Yes, of course. One of Leo Laporte's sponsors is Carbonite, which is cloud storage backup offline in their secure servers. So I'm sure he would recommend that, as I use myself. So, and if you don't do it yet, you should too. let's see. We just got a couple more minutes left, and let me just look here and see what. Oh, I did want to pass this along. The Sioux says that he doesn't understand a lot of the engineering stuff, but he wants me to thank you for just giving the world your music.
That's very nice. Thank you.
Yes. Here's another question. Any new albums that you're working on from the Alan Parsons Project or other names that we might expect sometime soon?
One of the spin-offs of doing the Art and Science of Sound recording DVD series has been some sessions which we did, in order to show certain techniques in the studio, and one of those sessions is heavily featured in the program, and there's a song called All Our Yesterdays, which you can find at iTunes if it interests you. But also, as another spin-off, we've been doing what we call masterclass training sessions for ASSR, which have meant that we've booked a commercial studio, booked a first-class band of musicians, and made tickets to attend the sessions available to those who have You know, the interest to come along and watch me making music, you know. Mm. And that's been hugely successful, and we've already got 3 songs in the can. And so eventually, so it's like sponsored recording.
Is that ongoing? Is that people still have an opportunity to come see future sessions?
Yes, they should keep an eye on the ASSR. That's a bit the abbreviation for Art and Science of Sound Recording. Keep an eye on the site. I think we're looking to do a session in Mexico City in the near future, possibly also Brazil. And we'll probably do another one in Los Angeles. The one we did recently was in Los Angeles, but it was a joy to do. We had some fantastic musicians. I worked with Vinnie Caliuta, the drummer, for the first time.
Fabulous drummer.
And we got Rami Jaffe from the Foo Fighters on keyboards, and Nathan East on bass, and it was a tremendous showing of talent, and everybody had a good time, and we came up with a great track. So eventually it will be on an Alan Parsons album. I just don't know how long it's going to take to. I'm also considering doing some sessions, perhaps without the public invited.
Well, the next time you have one in LA with the public invited, I hope to let me know, because I would come.
All right. Okay. Well, better than mine.
Excellent. One last question from A Monkey Mind. He wrote a while ago, he or she, you never can tell in the chat room. But it's a question that I thought was a good one. Do you feel that you've been hurt financially by piracy?
I think there's 2 ways of looking at it. I mean, downright piracy, yes, that's very damaging. When somebody literally counterfeits a product and sells it without the label and the artist getting paid, that's incredibly damaging. Mm-hmm. But people often use the word pirate in the context of illegal downloads, file sharing. I think file sharing has been damaging, and I think interestingly, I don't think. Major damage was done by Napster back in the day. The most damaging site now, I believe, to be YouTube. You can look up any song, any artist, and it's there on YouTube, and no one's getting paid for it. So,
what about the advantage of the exposure to a wider audience that might provide? Just to play devil's advocate.
That is playing devil's advocate, and it's a good counter argument. I mean, I think in moderation, or if YouTube would do like iTunes does and only play a minute of the song, then it might persuade people to actually pay for the product.
Yeah, but, exactly.
I foresee a day when there's going to be a gigantic lawsuit against YouTube for allowing copyright material to be shown. Without the copyright owners being paid, But it's great for struggling young artists that are trying to get their new product out to the masses. It's wonderful for that, but the people who used to, or who still do, rely on record sales, CD sales, downloads for their livelihood. Mm-hmm. It's been disastrous.
Yeah. Well, it's a very tricky situation. That undoubtedly will continue to be debated. One last question before we go, and we're running just slightly over here. I've had a number of people ask, if you were on a desert island and you had only one microphone and mic preamp, what would it be?
Wow. I think the microphone would, provided I could keep it working.
Yes, keep the sand microphone out of it.
Yeah. It would be a Neumann U47 original valve tube microphone, condenser mic. Interestingly, the preamp would not be such a difficult choice, because until quite recent years, I would just use the preamps in the consoles. I mean, Dark Side of the Moon, you know, all the Beatles stuff, stuff I did with Paul McCartney, the Hollies, all those things were just using console preamps.
Really? That's kind of surprising.
I'm very keen on Aphex mic pre's. That's what I've got over here. As you can see there, my rack.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see that? Yeah. Yep. Those two silver ones are Aphex units.
Uh-huh.
Universal Audio. I mean, the wonderful electronics that they make too. So So a Neumann 47, and just any preamp that delivers.
And of course, on that desert island, you'd also need a isolation booth and a computer and a bunch of other stuff.
And my wife, hopefully.
Hopefully so. Well, listen, Alan, it's been a fabulous hour, just fascinating information and a great conversation. I want to thank you so much for agreeing to be on this, my 100th episode. Thank you.
Well, congratulations again on that.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You bet. You can reach Alan at alanparsonsmusic.com or artandscienceofsound.com for that great DVD series on how to what you need to know to become an engineer. Alan, you're also on Twitter and Facebook, right?
Yes, in various places. I don't run my own Facebook or Twitter pages, but if you Google, my name, and you'll find Facebook and Twitter pages, I'm sure.
Okay, very good. You can find me online, of course, at hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv with suggestions for future guests or questions, which I answer on hometheater.com. You can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be John Schindler, the Vice President of Product Development at Vizio. So we'll be talking about cinema-wide TVs and Google TV and all the cool stuff that Vizio is up to these days. So I sure hope you'll join me for that. Until then, geek out.